How is it that human beings do terrible things to their own kind? How could anyone with any kind of moral code commit or even abide genocide or slavery? How could the Holocaust have happened? One explanation, the people committing the atrocities truly do not believe that their victims also are human. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. David Livingstone Smith, in his book Less Than Human, sheds light on why we demean, enslave, and exterminate others. We'll discuss the book with him this morning and seek to understand what it means to be human and to view others as something less. Mr. Smith is one of the 2012 winners of the prestigious Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. We'll also meet this morning with another winner, David Blight, author of American Oracle, a view of the Civil War at its centennial through the works of accomplished authors of the Civil Rights era. Has our understanding evolved as we reach the sesquicentennial? The Anisfield Wolf winners of nonfiction, right after this news. It's the Sound of Ideas from 90.3 WCPN Idea Stream. I'm Mike McIntyre. Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm honored to welcome to Studio 4 this morning two authors of acclaimed and important nonfiction works. And their latest acclaim, both of them this evening, will receive the 2012 Anisfield Wolf Award for their most recent works. This is one of those days where I just feel fortunate to have a job that allows me to be in conversation with such learned people and to examine important topics. We'll discuss this morning what makes us human and what about humans makes some of us able to commit horrendous atrocities, to demean, enslave, and exterminate others. And we'll look at the impact of the Civil War and how it continues to have impact on our nation. Does our collective perspective match the record that the Civil War at its heart was about slavery and also about the necessary end of slavery? Cleveland poet and philanthropist Edith Anisfield Wolfe established the book prizes in 1935 in honor of her father, John Anisfield, and husband, Eugene Wolfe, to reflect her family's passion for issues of social justice. The award celebrates works that increase our understanding of racism and cultural diversity. The Cleveland Foundation, the world's first community foundation, has administered the Anisfield Wolf Prize since 1963, and before then, the Saturday Review sponsored the awards. The jury is overseen by Henry Louis Gates, Jr., the acclaimed scholar, lecturer, writer, and editor. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our guest, two of this year's winners. David Blight is a public historian, a professor of history, and director of Yale University's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He's a native of Flint, Michigan, and his book is American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. Morning, David, and congratulations.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. And also with us is David Livingstone Smith. He's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of New England in Maine, where he teaches the philosophies of biology, ethics, metaphysics, mind, psychology, and the history of philosophy. He was born in New York City, grew up in South Florida, had a long stint in academia in London as well. His book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. David, welcome this morning.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
Both of us, all three of us were talking this morning about what an honor it must be for the two of you to have this award and looking at the list of previous winners to be in that pantheon.
It's incredibly humbling, and I can't help wondering if there's some mistake that's been made.
I just double-checked on the website. You guys are good. Terrific. And the awards, as I mentioned, are tonight. Our conversation, though, is right now. And if you'd like to ask questions of our authors, if you'd like to probe any of these topics, if you have a differing opinion or an affirming one, feel free to give us a call and join our conversation. 216-578-0903 is the number to call. You can also reach us toll-free, 866-578-0903, or send us an email, as always, news@WCPN.org is the way to get your thoughts heard via email as well. And we'll spend the first part of the show, just a little bookkeeping here, we'll spend the first part of the show discussing Less Than Human. And David Blight, I invite you to ask questions of your fellow author as well as our listeners.
Sure.
And me. And after our first break today, we'll dig into American Oracle. And the same offer for you, David Livingstone Smith, to ask questions of your fellow author. And we'll work the phone calls in along the way as well. And if you just don't get enough here, Dee Peary will be talking with Skip Gates on around noon. And she'll also be meeting with the fiction winner and the Lifetime Achievement winner. It's Book Owl Day here at Idea Stream. So a lot of really good information. We call it the all-day brain food, and today is really exemplifies that. Let me start then, David Livingstone Smith, with you. Did you get to the heart of what actually defines a human?
Well, that's a really interesting question. It turns out to be a difficult question to answer. If we look at the way that the word human is used, both in the vernacular and amongst scientists like paleoanthropologists, we find it's not used consistently. So in the scientific sphere, some people equate human with being members of the species Homo sapiens, others members of the species Homo, and there are various other options. And if we look at the vernacular, people often exclude members of their own biological species from the category of the human. So really the way human works is as what we call an indexical term. An indexical term is a term the meaning of which is determined by the context of its utterance. So if I say, I'm here, here is an indexical term.
Okay.
It means the place where the word here is uttered. I think human works that way. I think human boils down to something like my own kind. When we say human, we mean my own kind.
But how narrow is the definition of my own kind?
Well,
that's really the crux of this.
It is unfortunately highly flexible. We can extrude individuals from the category my own kind, and we can include them as well. And when we extrude them from that category, then we have a necessary condition for dehumanization.
216-578-0903 is the number to call to speak with author David Livingstone Smith about the book Less Than Human. And let's talk about that. When we do extrude a group of people and say that they are less than human, that they are subhuman.
Yeah.
Through history, this is not a new construct. Through history, this has occurred. And as I looked through your book, I wondered, is this a matter of convenience? Is it, I want to dominate you, and so I will convince myself that you're not of me? Or is it the other way around? I'm convinced that you are somehow harmful to me because you're not human, and so that for that reason, I will exterminate you.
Well, I have a view on this, but let me preface my view by saying that for such an important topic, the literature is extraordinarily thin. And so you should take anything I say with a grain of salt. In this book, I'm trying to start a conversation. I'm trying to get people to take this subject seriously.
Which is really shocking that you're at the very beginning of this kind of discussion, given what we've been through.
I found it astonishing, actually, to discover that by and large, the literature consists of a few dozen papers by social psychologists. Given the prima facie significance of this, given the atrocities of the past, in which it is generally acknowledged by scholars that dehumanization has played an important part, given the frequency with which the term is used in the scholarly literature and the lay literature alike, it is really an eye-opener to discover that it just hasn't been studied. So, look, my view is that we do have the capacity to recognize other members of our species as members of our species, like any animal. And so I think that dehumanization is actually a solution to a problem we encounter. It's a gimmick for dealing with a difficulty. And that difficulty has to do with the inhibitions against acts of violence, which are activated when we recognize another person as a fellow human being, as members of our own kind.
Part of our human DNA, our moral code, is not to harm other humans in some ways, right? Is that built in?
Yeah, well, this is, in fact, it's deeper. This is characteristic of social animals generally, that lethal violence against a member of the group is inhibited. It occurs, but it's inhibited, whereas between group violence is much more frequent. Now, see, we human beings have this great big brain, and we have the capacity to conceive of others as members of us. So the inhibitions in our case aren't biological inhibitions against doing violence to a member of a local breeding group. We have this umbrella concept of the human. But it's often advantageous to do harm to others. It's often advantageous to exploit their labor without recompense. It's often advantageous to steal their resources, to do terrible acts of violence. And so if you think of that, we human beings, when we wish to do these things, we're between a rock and a hard place. We have the inhibitions against doing harm to others, and we have the incentive. And I think that dehumanization is a way of disabling the inhibitions so as to perform self-aggrandizingly advantageous acts of violence against others.
This is how Armenians would be referred to as dogs, or Namibians as baboons, or Jews as rats.
Yes, and another very important point here, it's not just referring to them. It's very important. I think one reason dehumanization hasn't been studied properly is that it's typically assumed to be some sort of metaphorical thing akin to name-calling. Mm. Well, name-calling, calling someone in an argument a bitch, say, is different from conceiving them as a rat-like organism. Name-calling is the use of words as a weapon. But what dehumanization does is it, in fact, releases, it disinhibits aggression.
216-578-0903 is the phone number to call. When you explain that is, in some ways there's convenience here, that you're between the rock and the hard place, and this is a way to get to the point where you need to treat people this way, it makes me think that you're manipulating this situation. And yet, the people that are buying into this, and you give examples in the book about the Holocaust and the folks that were with the Nazi program, they weren't thinking to themselves, I'm creating a gimmick and therefore I'm able to do this. They truly bought into this feeling that they're getting rid of disease, the Jewish disease.
Yes, indeed.
And so how does that – does there have to be one person that knows the facade and the rest of the people buy into it? Does it have to be a group that treats people this way, or could it be individuals?
No, of course it can be an individual that does. But dehumanization generally applies to a whole population. And it's, by the way, intimately tied with ideas of race and racism, because if you want to demarcate a population, to make them other, the first step is to employ the fiction of race, to think that, yeah, they're people, but they're deep down, they're people of a different kind.
And along those lines, biblically, there are folks that would believe that black people are not of Adam and Eve.
Oh, yeah. This was a very common justification of the brutalities handed out to sub-Saharan Africans and later African Americans, that they're not truly human beings. They're not of the lineage of Adam and Eve. They were either descendants of the serpent of Eden, or made from debris left by the Great Flood, or descendants of animals that Noah took on his ark. There are various biblical fantasies of that sort.
And getting back to that point about whether people truly, truly believe that this race of people or this group of people are subhuman, this, again, is not something they know that they're doing and saying, I'm using this as a justification. Well, this is the true belief.
It is a true belief, yes. That's how it motivates. You know, a lot of what we do isn't deliberate, conscious, and thought out. So it was the very sincerity of, say, Joseph Goebbels' view that Jews were subhuman creatures that allowed him to be such an advocate of the final solution.
Yeah, one of the things that blew me away, I think this is an example you gave in the book, and I think it was Goebbels, that you talked about watching a video of a ritualistic kosher killing of an animal. Mm-hmm. And so this animal is killed and dressed, and he's looking at it saying, look at this barbarian.
Yeah.
How could they do this to an animal? Mm-hmm. As he's then exterminating that particular vermin in his mind. So truly he believed he was watching their barbarism.
Yeah, very strangely that the Nazis were very big on animal welfare. And you know, Hitler was a vegetarian, anti-vivisectionist, and so it's a very curious juxtaposition. I mean, Goebbels, it's been suggested by an important historian of the Holocaust that Goebbels wished to include that specifically because he knew it would upset Hitler, given Hitler's fondness for non-human animals.
Wow. David Blight, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask David to reflect a little, if you would, of where you may come down on this almost ubiquitous question now. The neuroscientists are telling us that we may only control a certain small capacity of what we do and so on. Is it possible to reflect on how hardwired we are for this versus how this is learned behavior? Does the killer of the dehumanized other act out of nature? to some degree? Do we have to learn it? Your book has so much to say about this problem.
Okay, that's a very good question and a very complex question.
Yeah.
And invites a somewhat speculative answer.
Sure.
You got 14 seconds. No,
let's go. Look, I think I don't like the term hardwired.
Uh-huh. Most
human beings have certain psychological dispositions.
Right.
And those psychological dispositions provide the raw materials for dehumanization.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we tend to carve the world up, and this is a widespread, natural, normal disposition. We tend to carve the world up into kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
And we tend to imagine those kinds of things have essences or something that makes them the kinds of things that
mm-hmm.
they are. We also tend to order the world in terms of a hierarchy of values. Some
mm-hmm.
things are more perfect. They have greater intrinsic value mm-hmm. than others. I think that's actually necessary to any kind of morality.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make
mm-hmm.
distinctions between what sort of behavior is permissible
in
relation to what. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we have these two tendencies. Now, these work in tandem
mm-hmm.
to produce dehumanization under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain circumstances of social conflict. Learning certainly does come into it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a culturally saturated
mm-hmm.
phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And propaganda comes into it
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there are a whole lot of forces working together here.
One of the things I get from David's question, though, is can we do anything about it? If we know our history, is there a way to somehow allow the human not to treat other humans that way? Is there some hope?
Well, I hope so. I hope there is
well,
so.
if it's hardwired, as he described, and I know you didn't mm-hmm. like the word, but if it's something that's...
No, but I don't think it is hardwired. I think that there are some psychological tendencies that are, if we're going to use the word, hardwired, that is difficult not to engage in. But we can work against those as well if we're sufficiently vigilant, if we know that they're there, if they're not reinforced constantly. I mean, here's a really good example. The idea of race. The idea of race is reinforced constantly
mm-hmm.
in our society and many others. We have to check these stupid boxes off forms and so on and so forth. But that's not inevitable. We can change that.
Mm-hmm.
We can change it. It might be hard. And even though we have this natural tendency to divide human populations up like that with some education, with some vigilance and so on, we can at least modulate it.
It's a perfect segue. When we come back from our break, we'll be talking with David Blight about his book. And certainly there was a whole lot of segmentation and racial division as we talk about the view of the Civil War from 100 years later during the Civil Rights Movement. And before we get to that, when we come back from our break, we will take a couple of phone calls from you for David Livingstone Smith on his book as well, Less Than Human. So do stay with us. Do call to talk to both David Livingstone Smith about Less Than Human and to David Blight about his book, American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. We're back in just a minute.
Each year, a number of book awards are presented, but Dr. Henry Louis Gates, chair of Cleveland's 77-year-old Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, explains why that prize is so special.
It's unique. It's sui generis. There is nothing like it in the United States. It was called the Black Pulitzer Prize.
Today around noon, find out more about this prestigious honor and meet this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Award winners. That's around noon today on 90.3.
You're back with The Sound of Ideas on 90.3 WCPN. I'm Mike McIntyre. It's about 9:26 a.m., and we're talking this morning with the Annisfield Wolf Book Award winners for nonfiction. David Livingstone Smith is with us this morning, author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. And we've been having a very fascinating conversation about that this morning, about our humanity and our ability to treat others as less than human. We're also going to be speaking with David Blight about American Oracle, the Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. This is a view 100 years out from the Civil War. We're now 150 years out. How have things changed in that last 50 years? We'll get into that throughout the program as well. Right now, though, let's go to the phones and talk to Laura in West Park, who has a question or a comment for David Livingstone Smith. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. I have to tell you, Mike, I just posted something on Facebook to say, if you're not listening to Mike McIntyre's show on WCPN, you ought to. This is a
Thank
fantastic
you.
Discussion. Thank you so much for having these folks on. And, David, I have to tell you, I grew up in a civil war in the Middle East, and I've always thought, or at least in my kind of adulthood, I've always thought that the reason our side was able to kill on the other side and vice versa is because we didn't think of them as equal human beings. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that if we knew them, if we looked at them in the eye before we shot them, we probably couldn't shoot them.
Well, that's a really, really good point, and thank you for that comment. It's actually, if you're not a sociopath, it's very, very difficult to kill people close up, particularly when looking in their eyes. The eyes really are, psychologically speaking, the mirror of the soul. When we look at someone in the eyes, it's really hard to escape awareness of their humanity. And there are many accounts of combatants who have killed people under those circumstances, and they're often haunted by the experience for a lifetime.
Hmm. Excellent point. And when you look at the genocide in Rwanda, when you see the fight between two different groups of people, they don't think of each other as equally human.
That's correct. Yes. It's very frequent in war.
And yet, David Blight, we'll get into some more of the details about your book, but I wonder about that as it relates to the Civil War, because one of the things that happens, and what I'm hearing here, is when you're at war with an enemy, the enemy is less than human. When you're in the Civil War, you're at war with your brother. Mm-hmm. I wonder about how about the attitudes of the Civil War there and how they play out. Do you guys have any thoughts about
that,
David?
That's a question I've been asked from time to time, and I think it's a fascinating question, and I always have to answer, I don't know. And this is something I'd really like to investigate.
Well, actually, I think the American Civil War shows us at least a good deal of examples that brothers, too, can be dehumanized. Mm. If by brother we mean fellow countrymen,
right,
who speaks the same language, prays to the same God, the degree of war propaganda that set in the South and the North to demonize secessionist, Confederates, Southerners, slaveholders on one side, and to demonize Yankees on the other is extraordinary. I've written a great deal about Frederick Douglass, the great black leader.
And you have a book coming out.
I'm doing a new biography, but my original book was a treatment of Douglass's sense of the meaning of the Civil War. Well, one of the things Frederick Douglass did after the Civil War broke out is he became a thumping war propagandist. He created Southerners into kind of a horrible Hun.
Interesting.
Who needed to be defeated, and in some cases needed to be killed. Never used the language of extermination by any means, but nothing like an all-out civil war to make people to some degree dehumanize their enemy. And war, of course, once it gets bigger and bigger, the scale of war, the scope of war, the scope of suffering and death, watching your comrades die, of course, lends itself to that kind of dehumanization. You've killed enough of my brothers now. You deserve to be killed, too. It's a horrifying thing to watch, and it's one aspect of our civil war that we have probably collectively cleaned up too much.
Let's take another call on Less Than Human before we move a little more fully into American Oracle. And then throughout the program near the end, we'll take questions of any sort for both of our authors. So do stay on the line if you have a question we didn't get to. And if you'd like to join us, 216-578-0903 is the number, or 866-578-0903. You can send an email as well, news@wcpn.org. Serena is in downtown Cleveland. Hello, Serena.
Good morning to everyone. Can you hear me?
Yep, go right ahead.
Okay, great. First of all, Mike, I would like to thank you for all the hard work that you do, the variety of topics that you must have to research and stay up on, and always trying to give equal voice to both sides of issues, and I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Serena.
Let's see. My question is, how does dehumanization play with the election and events like Katrina? It seems that people are successfully segregating whites from blacks, blacks from Hispanics, whatever, by telling them that, for instance, that blacks, there are more blacks on welfare than whites. And so we You know, so blacks are using your money. They're wasting your money. Or that that for instance, the Katrina victims, that they didn't deserve to be rescued quickly. They're used to living like that. They're used to suffering, so we don't have to rescue them as quickly. So it seems like it's being those beliefs have been manifested, that people believe them, and they believe that if I vote for you, you will favor me when you get in office, and you will give me rights and privileges that other people don't deserve.
Let's delve into that, Serena. Okay. Good. All right. So, David Livingstone Smith.
Yeah. Thank you, Serena. And this raises a couple of important issues. One is that there are some explicit examples of dehumanization here. I mean, there have been many representations circling around of the president and the first lady as subhuman creatures, as monkeys or chimpanzees.
Because they're African American.
Because they're African American, that's right. And that's just blatant. That's just blatant.
Is that really a feeling of subhumanization as we talked about before, or is it simply a bigot? Is it simply somebody who doesn't really believe that, but that's the terminology they're using?
It's hard to tell. We need to be really cautious. That sort of ties into the next point, that exists, that dehumanization exists on a continuum of denigration. So we can make people other without thinking of them as subhuman. We can think of them as morally inferior others, as unworthy others, as defective human beings.
Inferior human beings.
Yes, that's right. So if you look at racism, there are degrees, right? So there are racists who think, I'll grant these are people. They're just not people with the at the same spiritual and mental level as ourselves. And then, you could represent the despised group as just, like children or having bestial sort of qualities without actually being subhuman. Dehumanization is the extreme of that. And we always have to be very, very cautious about that drift towards dehumanization, because it's really when a certain point is crossed that we're likely to have terrible atrocity.
Great question, Serena. Thanks so much for joining us with that. And let's talk a little bit more now about American Oracle, the book by David W. Blight. And speaking of dehumanization, the Civil War, is it agreed now among historians, and is this settled history, that the Civil War was about slavery and that it was about the abolition of slavery, or is there still vestiges of the lost cause notion?
Well, Mike, yes and no to that question. Among serious Civil War era scholars for actually generations now, there's been a clear and forceful consensus that without the problem of slavery and its expansion, there would never have been a Civil War. That's unequivocal in the scholarly community by and large. However, in public memory, that's not the case at all. Last year, on the anniversary of Fort Sumter, 150th anniversary, CNN did a poll. I don't know precisely how they conducted the poll nor precisely how they asked the question, but they came up with polling data that said that about 48% of Americans believe slavery was the principal cause of the war, but about 52% believed that principal cause came from a list of other things: tariffs, states' rights, conflicting economies, et cetera, et cetera. So there is always this distance between what you might call scholarly consensus and public memory. But whenever anyone wants to use the language of states' rights about the Civil War, the key is to ask them states' rights for what, to do what, to
right.
protect what, to
and
preserve what.
And that gets
what.
Back to the very point we just began with, right?
Right. Slavery was, slaves were, in 1860, the single largest financial asset in the entire American economy. Power is such a factor in this discussion we're having of either dehumanization or human exploitation. All forms of slavery have been power systems, and the political power behind American slavery is something that I think in the broad American popular memory, we still haven't penetrated far enough just how powerful a system this was.
Was this the viewpoint that was held by the four, actually five, if you can include the ending? Was this the view held by the authors, the lens through which you looked at the Civil War?
Yes, no question. I chose to write about five authors in this book who were particularly prominent during the 1950s and 60s in fiction, nonfiction, and in narrative history. Robert Penn Warren, Bruce Catton, Edmund Wilson, James Baldwin, and Ralph Ellison. And yes, all of them in their own unique ways, from their own perspectives, from their own regional backgrounds, from their racial backgrounds, were certainly believers in the idea that slavery was at the root of the Civil War and that its greatest result was emancipation as well as the preservation of the Union. Sure, they were. And they were voices with very large audiences. But they were up against, as you just suggested in your previous question, they were up against, and it's very hard sometimes today for people to grasp it, a deep and abiding lost cause tradition, which had sunk into American culture from the late 19th century well into the 20th century. This was the Southern argument or narrative or story that somehow the South had never really fought for slavery. They had fought for home. They had fought for their own...
for their rights.
For their rights, for their sovereignty to control their way of life, quote unquote. And that in that war, they fought a glorious fight against industrialization and superior numbers, and that a defeated cause can sometimes actually be the noblest cause. That had a powerful hold on the American imagination by the 1950s and 60s when the country was having its centennial commemoration of the Civil War.
It still exists in some quarters.
Absolutely.
In the sesquicentennial.
There's
but at
no
the
question.
Centennial, much more prevalent view. And
far
I wonder your decision to say, I'm going to look at this at exactly 100 years later, even though we're 150 years later.
Right.
And you open with in the 1963 I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King, in which the very first words that he gives in this speech harken back to Gettysburg 100 years previous. So tell me about how the two of these relate, the civil rights movement and the Civil War.
That's really the ultimate point of the book, is to try to show that in the late 50s and 1960s, this country tried to have a huge national commemoration, often called celebration, of the Civil War at the same time. We were in the midst of the Civil Rights Revolution. These two phenomena of remembering the Civil War and acting out the Civil Rights Revolution, in effect, never could find the same space together. The two phenomena were like separate planets orbiting separate suns. The country didn't know how to try to embrace the civil rights movement at the same time it commemorated the war. And obviously the great irony of that is that they were about the same subject. I opened the book with King's dream speech for what may seem obvious reasons to readers, but that speech is almost entirely remembered today, and American children grow up learning it, but they only learn the last 3 minutes of it. The first 14 of 17 minutes of that great speech is a Civil War centennial speech.
The scripted part of it.
Absolutely. The scripted part of that speech, the poetry of that speech is not just in the dream metaphor. It's in the ways that King found to remind the country it's 100 years later. He uses that refrain four times in the first paragraph. 100 years later after emancipation. 100 years later after the Civil War.
And in fact, the first line's five score.
Five score, of course, appeals to Lincoln behind him and the Gettysburg Address. He is saying 100 years out, my fellow Americans, explicitly, he says, the Negro is not free. He is using brilliantly that anniversary, 1963, Emancipation Proclamation, to remind the country that the promise of emancipation has not been fulfilled.
And I wonder if we look 50 years past that time in the book, would you say that we're closer, no closer?
Oh, we're definitely closer. There's no
question. But not there?
Oh, no, not there at all. In fact, that's why I use Ralph Ellison in the epilogue of this book, and I'll leave that story to readers. Every time, it seems to me, every time we feel like we've experienced great progress in our racial history, and we have, Emancipation is one great example. The 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts, the success of the rights phase of the civil rights movement absolutely changed the entire society in the United States.
13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Exactly. But every time we experience these great movements forward, or revolutions if you want, there's always a counter-revolution. I'll never forget the morning after the election of Barack Obama. Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, important columnist, opening sentence of his column the next morning, he couldn't resist. His sentence was, "Last night at 10 p.m. in Grant Park, Chicago, United States of America, the Civil War ended." Hmm. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, God, how could he even think that? Now, of course, we know it didn't. The reaction, as David was saying earlier, to Obama, the racialized reaction to Obama, the elements of hatred that are out there in American society that appear not to be able to cope with an African-American president have shown their face. Every time we experience great progress forward, there is always a reaction to it, but it doesn't mean we haven't had progress. There's no question today, 50 years on from the Civil War centennial, the lost cause has much less traction across American society. We have made tremendous progress in schooling and textbooks and in educating the public about the central role of slavery in the Civil War. The Civil War is no longer your granddaddy's Civil War. It's now a great story of social and political and constitutional transformation. There is much to be honored, if you like, and celebrated about that kind of progress. On the other hand, as I pointed out from that polling data, it appears that still half of American society don't fully believe that slavery was at the root of this war.
I wonder what you think. Are you one of those 48% who believe slavery was at the heart of the war, or something otherwise? And do you think that progress has been made? And clearly it has. But what are your thoughts on that progress in the last 50 years since the centennial? Join us at 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. We're taking our last quick break here. When we come back, we're going to take your phone calls and talk with both David Livingstone Smith and David Blight about their works honored this evening in the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. It's the Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. Back in just a minute.
WCPN's fall membership drive will be here soon. Join Wise Advertising and Consolidated Graphics Group in supporting the drive by organizing a group of 6 volunteers to answer phones. How about your organization? Visit WCPN.org or call 216-916-6100 for more information.
It's the Sound of Ideas from 90.3. Coming up in the next hour, it's the Diane Rehm Show. And tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, Rick Jackson is in the host chair for the weekly news roundup. Right now, we're talking with the nonfiction winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, which recognize books that have made important contributions to our understanding of racism and our appreciation of the rich diversity of human cultures. With us in studio are David Blight, author of American Oracle, The Civil War and the Civil Rights Era, and David Livingstone Smith, author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean and Slave and Exterminate Others. Later today on Around Noon, Dee Perry talks with fiction winner Essie Adugyan, who wrote the novel Half-Blood Blues, and Arnold Rampersand, who receives the Lifetime Achievement Award. He's written biographies of poet Langston Hughes, tennis star Arthur Ashe, and Jackie Robinson, among others. We'll stream the award ceremony live on our website at 6 o'clock this evening. You can find a link to that at WCPN.org/SOI. And if you'd like to join the conversation right now, 866-578-0903. We've got about 10 minutes or so left in the program. You can also send us an email. News at WCPN.org is the address. And a question from Orlando, who says, Orlando the person, not the city, who says, what if our inhumanity or the doom of it all or the pointlessness of it all or the randomness of it all were true, what would you do? Or is it enough that those questions are unknown or unknowable? It's kind of a broad philosophical question. Sorry, guys. And go.
I don't think it's all random or pointless or anything. I think there's a lot very meaningful.
It's a rather existential view that he has of that, but you would say that you reject that notion.
Absolutely.
Let's have a phone call here, and we'll have Ryan in Parma join us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. What's on your mind?
Listen, the Civil War was a war of real transition. The Gatling gun, the better equipment, and so forth. Also, the idea of the honorable war, each side allowing to remove victims and wounded people off the battlefield, so forth, all started in the war. But by the end of the war, Sherman's drive to the sea, the complete destruction of the city of Savannah, the move from Savannah up north, the idea of 20 miles each side of a line was completely stripped. So it was the beginning of transition to all war for all people. Civilians were no longer exempt, and they used to be, and this was worldwide. The Crimea is another example. So then, instead of an honorable enemy, other wars with other people, you started getting all the nicknames, which is the dehumanization. And there's wars, I won't give the names, but every war and every guy that was in the service like me were taught those names by DIs, the drill instructors in the Army. We were also told from day one, you are going to die, you are going to die, you are going to die, and then, with our bayonets, kill, kill.
And kill, yeah. And kill not another human being, but kill what you believed in your basic training to be something inferior to you, something inhuman, something dangerous.
Not really. The first beginning in when I was in the service was you're going to die, you're going to die. Now, that was in your brain. And so I'm going to kill, 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 so I'm not going to be one of the guys going to die.
Right. Interesting point. Let's talk a little bit about that. In some cases, it's treating the enemy as inhuman. What about your own mortality? In this case, it's an issue of survival, not necessarily the other person's inhumanity.
Well, that's certainly motivating, but there's work which indicates that even in life-threatening situations in combat, it's not easy to kill.
Yes, Civil War soldiers had to truly be taught to kill, even though they were farm boys and hunters and so on, often very good with weapons. They still had to be taught to kill. Now, the gentleman's point is very well taken, that the Civil War did become one of the first models in the world of a totalizing war, of a society on a society, which did require some degree of on this taxonomy of totalizing or dehumanizing. Once decisions were made that Southern society had to be crushed and destroyed, that meant civilians. And it was ultimately a war on civilian populations in parts of the South.
I'm sure you're not surprised that many people would like to get in on this discussion with you. So let's try to get as many as we can in right now with Fred on the East Side. Hi, Fred.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Well, I wanted to say that I think the Civil War was an issue like politics today. Everyone has an issue that they're fighting for. You probably have some people in the North that didn't want slavery ended but wanted the money and wanted some other issues, so went along with the purpose of the slaves had to be free. So I just think that it's just like today. Nothing's really changed. Everyone has Democrats can be against Democrats, Republicans against Republicans, just different issues people have, and that was just one of the benefits of freeing slaves that came about.
Well, I would never say nothing's ever changed. You're quite right that there were vast numbers of white Northerners who were not in favor of freeing the slaves, and that was the great risk that Lincoln and his administration was taking by announcing emancipation. But wars have a logic. Wars, especially when they last long enough, develop their own logic. It's a terrible logic. And in the case of the Civil War, that logic became that the only way to win the war was to defeat Southern society and Southern morale, and to do that, you had to destroy slavery. A lot of white Northerners got converted to the idea of freeing the slaves because they realized it was the only way to win the war.
It wasn't necessarily a moralistic reason for freeing slaves.
It was for some, but not for others.
For others, yeah. It was an economic reason.
Sure.
Or just a military reason.
Lincoln actually did use the language military necessity in the Emancipation Proclamation for good reason.
We have an email from Dennis who takes issue with some of the discussion we've been having. He said, I'm listening to your show when Serena called and said that citizens of New Orleans were not rescued because they were black. I don't think that's exactly what she said, but she asked about whether or not there was a dehumanizing factor in slow response, which has been a criticism. He says he can't believe that the caller wasn't challenged on her assertion, and I felt it was right to allow her to give her viewpoint. But Dennis's viewpoint, though, is that Katrina was a terrible storm which wreaked havoc over a huge geographical area, and I think for the most part, heroic actions were taken to save people regardless of color. And Dennis, thank you for that point. He then, though, goes on to ask you, David Livingstone Smith. He takes you to task for saying that some people consider the Obamas to be subspecies and wants to know how it is that you can say such a thing.
Oh, I say that simply on the basis of some of the really vile representations that have gone around of
so
the
it's
Obamas.
Not necessarily an indication that this is a pervasive societal attitude.
Oh no, absolutely not.
Right, an outlier. But
yeah,
but the fact
well,
of the matter is,
as your caller said. It is some people.
Actually, I think I put in the word some.
He, okay.
His contention was that you stated that people consider the Obamas to be a subspecies. You didn't say that. You did say some.
The word people is ambiguous, actually. It could be some or it could be all. Of course, I don't mean all.
Okay.
That would be absurd.
Fair enough. We've got that cleared up. Let's have a call now from Marcus on the east side. Hi, Marcus.
How you doing, Michael? Good morning.
Very good to have you. Good morning to you.
I just wanted to say I was listening in. And I came to Cleveland from New Orleans. And when I heard the comment about people being dehumanized, I said, I have to say something. The fact is, the mayor of New Orleans at the time, Ray Nagin, was an African-American. He was a Democrat. The governor at the time was also a Democrat. And the fact that they did not get along is what led to the lack of response of public resources. It had nothing to do with black folks or white folks. And the fact that people are still having a conversation about that when there were tens of thousands of people that responded to Katrina by taking off work, by taking off school, and going there to help rebuild the place, we never really like to talk about our better angels. We so often want to, dehumanize even our own responses to these things.
That's an interesting point, Marcus, and I appreciate you bringing that up. And Serena certainly kicked a hornet's nest on that one. Thank you so much for your call. Let's ask Denise in South Euclid for her thoughts now. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, thank you for the books. They sound fascinating. I'm looking forward to reading them. My question is, I wonder if the dehumanization is taking place in our current American culture based on age. There are all sorts of studies regarding different levels of punishment for people who kill children versus people who kill adults. It also, I wonder if it enters into the whole abortion debate, and it's part of what keeps us from trying to resolve this issue because of, if that age goes back far enough. There are fascinating polls that talk about how there are people who consider abortion to be murder, and yet they think it's all right to keep it legal. So it's like we've somehow, managed to dehumanize that unborn child to the extent that it allows us to do away with them. And when I think about all these other studies going, based on age, I wonder if that is a factor, if that is a possible cause, that dehumanization.
All right, Denise, thank you. David Livingstone Smith, what about those issues?
I'll just, for reasons of time, confine myself to the latter issue. You're absolutely right. The abortion debate is philosophically really interesting here because what comes into play is competing conceptions of what human means. And as I've indicated right at the beginning of the program, I don't think there's actually a fact about what beings are human and what are not. It's more akin to an honorific title. You accord someone a certain sort of moral status by calling them human because you're including them in the same category as yourself. And the debate about that abortion is really fascinating and actually quite important in this respect.
And I think you'd have a debate about whether it's science that you're talking about or whether it's social attitudes. I mean, there's a whole lot that goes into that.
There are competing conceptions of, of how we should understand the human here, and competing conceptions of the moral implications of assigning someone more human status.
Denise, thanks so much for the call. And sorry to say, that's going to have to be the last one. There are folks who would love to join the conversation, I see, on our phone line. I'm going to tell you in just a moment how you can do that. And I want to say again, congratulations to you and terrific job on the show today as well. I'm sure that this is an indicator that the program this evening at the Ohio Theater is going to be a terrific one. David Livingstone Smith, author of Less Than Human, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank you too, David Blight, author of American Oracle. I appreciate your being here.
Thanks so much, Mike.
And the term American Oracle coming from Robert Penn Warren, the idea that the Civil War is an oracle for us. We do keep going back to it for insight, and today was another example of that. Thank you so much for being here. And if you'd like to get the last word on the topic today, there are many ways to do it. If you're hanging on our line right now, go ahead and hang up and give us a call back at 216-916-6397. That's 916-NEWS. And you can leave a comment there. You can write to us online, news@wcpn.org. We're also on Twitter at Sound of Ideas, and we're on Facebook as well. And again, to remind you that this afternoon at noon, on Around Noon, Dee Perry will talk to other winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. The Sound of Ideas is produced by Paul Cox and Katie Baker. Our technical producer is Lawrence Caswell, with help from Jack Helbig. Stephen Bond is at the controls of the webcast. Mark Rosenberger is the director of production. Our executive editor is David Mulpes. Rick Jackson is here tomorrow to talk about the news of the week. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for listening.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.